Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. On Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 2009, in Palm Beach County, Florida, Paul Michael Merhige joined his family of more than a dozen relatives for Thanksgiving dinner at his cousin Muriel Sitton's home in Jupiter, Florida. Unfortunately, this would be the Thanksgiving dinner from hell. Paul was a well-liked teenager who graduated third in his class from Gulliver Prep in Miami, Florida. He played sports, was the football team kicker, and led the French Honor Society. However, while at the University of Miami, Paul's mental state changed, and his OCD got out of control. He also began experiencing chronic depression. Then, he and his sister, Carla, started having issues that involved the court system. In 1996, Paul accused Carla of breaking his door down, screaming at him, and said she spit in his face before wrestling him to the floor. From this, he requested a restraining order against her, but he eventually dropped the request. At the time, Paul was being treated for his OCD, and he said the family members would purposely harass him even though they knew he was seeking treatment. However, this is from Paul's point of view, and the family told a different story. Paul's parents said he was mentally disturbed, and when he lived with them, they slept with their bedroom doors locked because they were scared of him. They said he had a lot of demons, but wasn't always taking his medicine. In 1999, Paul tried to take his own life by shooting himself in the chest, but survived after the bullet grazed one of his lungs. In 2005, he tried again by swallowing all the pills he had left in his medicine cabinet. Then, in April 2006, Carla accused Paul of threatening to kill her with a knife and requested a restraining order against him. However, a month later, on May 12th, Carla chose to drop the request. So, when Paul decided to join the family for Thanksgiving dinner, it was quite a shock. His cousin, Muriel, hadn't even seen him in 12 years. For the next 3 hours, it seemed like everything was going well. They had Thanksgiving dinner and sang songs around the piano, and there were no conflicts. However, during that time, Paul sat quietly and ate nothing. As the get-together was winding down, Paul went to his car and returned with a gun and first shot his sister, Carla, before turning the gun on his other sister, Carla's twin, Lisa Knight, who was pregnant. He was then heard saying that he waited 20 years to kill them. Sadly, Paul didn't stop there and fatally shot his aunt Ramonde Joseph and his cousin's daughter, Michaela Sitton. After killing the four family members, he fled the scene in his 2007 blue four-door Toyota Camry. Paul fled to the Florida Keys, where he planned to take his own life. However, 5 weeks later, on January 2, 2010, the family of the Edgewater Resort, where Paul had rented a room, recognized him and called the authorities. He had checked into the resort under the name John Baca, and when police burst into his second floor room, they found him on his computer checking for updates on the manhunt. After being arrested, he was charged with 4 counts of premeditated murder and 3 counts of attempted first-degree murder for wounding other members at the get-together. Paul had planned out the murders ahead of time by buying 4 guns, packing some clothes, and withdrawing $12,000 in cash. He even swapped the license plate on his Camry and kept it covered while in the motel parking lot. Jim and Muriel then sued Paul's parents, but the lawsuit was thrown out because Paul was an adult, and the judge said that Florida had never held parents accountable for their adult child's actions. Lisa Knight's husband, Patrick, also tried suing Paul's parents, but that suit was also thrown out. In the end, Paul was sentenced to 7 life terms. However, Michaela's father, Jim, said he felt that Paul deserved the death penalty.
Anything could happen. Being a female, you could be robbed if you're a male, all the way to where you could be killed. Once you get in that other person's car, you're at their mercy.
Kara Evelyn Knott was born in Ventura, California on February 11, 1966. In 1986, 20-year-old Kara was a student at San Diego State University and was described as a responsible, lively, and an all-around cheerful person. On the night of December 27th, Kara went to her boyfriend Wayne Bautista's house to spend some time. When she was ready to leave, she called her parents and told them she was heading home. At 8:27 p.m., Kara was seen pumping gas at a Chevron station. After leaving the station, she was never seen alive again. The drive usually took around 45 minutes, but by 10 p.m., Kara was nowhere to be found. That's when Kara's father, Sam, said a feeling of doom overtook him, and he decided to go search for her. Sam and his wife, Joyce, began driving along the freeway looking for Kara's white Volkswagen Beetle. Even her boyfriend, Wayne, got involved, and they all spent the next 8 hours looking for her. Sam even stopped a couple of California Highway Patrol officers and asked for help in the search, but they told him she would have to be missing for 24 hours. Finally, after 6 a.m. on December 28th, he noticed a police cruiser getting off the Mercy Road off-ramp and decided to follow him. The officer pulled into the off-ramp, and he noticed his daughter Cynthia and her husband William standing there. That's when he saw Kara's car parked at the bottom of the off-ramp near the old Highway 395 bridge. They began calling out Kara's name, hoping she might answer, but sadly, she never did. When the area was finally searched, they found Kara's body 65 feet below the bridge in a dry creek bed. She had been strangled to death and then tossed from the roadway above. 2 days after Kara's body was discovered, California Highway Patrol officer Craig Pyer took a news crew from NBC in San Diego on a ride-along, explaining the dangers of allowing a stranger into the car and how female drivers can protect themselves. After the broadcast, more than a dozen callers, mostly women, contacted authorities about 38-year-old Officer Pyer, who had been on the force for 13 years. The caller said that Pyer had pulled them over in the same general area where Kara was found. They said he wasn't violent, but kept them there for close to an hour, asking strange questions about their personal lives. He would even stroke the hair and shoulders of the women he pulled over. Officer Pyer even had a complaint filed against him a month before Kara's murder for pulling over a lady's daughter for no apparent reason. It was becoming more and more clear that Officer Pyer was not your friendly neighborhood officer, but a potential highway predator who would prey on young female drivers. He had been married twice, and both his ex-wives revealed that Pyer had become Mr. Macho after joining the highway patrol and began using his badge to flirt with women. Shirley Schwartz, an attendant at a gas station on Kearney Villa Road, said that Pyer had pulled into the station about 9:30 p.m. on the night of the murder to buy gas for his cruiser. She said he appeared nervous and disheveled and had 3 scratch marks on the right side of his nose. She even asked him how he was doing, to which he responded, "It had been a rough night." Then, Highway Patrol Officer Joseph Riordan told investigators he saw Pyer at 10:30 p.m. and noticed his uniform was disheveled and he had blood on his forehead and his hands. When asked about the scratches, he said he fell into a chain-link fence. Joyce told authorities that she and Kara had taken a self-defense class together and were trained to claw at an attacker's face and eyes, which could explain the scratches on his face. A man by the name of Jean-Pierre Gouley and his brother Robert came forward and said that Pyer had pulled them over at about 10 p.m. for having a defective taillight. Pyer gave them a citation, but changed the time on it from 10 p.m. to a time around when Kara was murdered. It was clear he was trying to falsify his logbook to show he wasn't near the Mercy Road exit. Even more evidence against Pyer was found at the crime scene. Forensics had found a gold rayon fiber on Kara's dress that matched a shoulder patch that Pyer wore on his uniform. They also found the rarest blood type, AB negative, on Kara's sweatshirt and boots, which matched Pyer's. They then found a rope in his patrol car that matched the strangle pattern on her neck. With all the evidence mounting up against Pyer, he was arrested on January 15, 1987, and charged with Kara's murder. As for a motive, it's thought that Pyer began doing to Kara what he typically did to female drivers, but Kara wasn't having it. Prosecutors alleged that she threatened to tell on him, which led to an altercation. Pyre, thinking the situation could put his marriage and career at risk, decided to strangle her to death. While his first trial ended in a hung jury, the second trial, in June 1988, would go much better after his third wife was brought in to testify. She said that when Pyre returned home on December 27th, around 11 p.m., she noticed fresh scratches on his face. However, she never inquired about the scratches and didn't believe he could murder anyone. In the end, Pyre was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to 25 years to life. Since Pyre continued to maintain his innocence, a program designed to exonerate those who were wrongfully convicted asked him to submit his DNA in 2004. However, he refused. A parole hearing that same year asked why he wouldn't submit his DNA, but he wouldn't answer, and his parole was denied. Kara's family eventually sued the California Highway Patrol for ignoring a harassment complaint against Pyre and were awarded a $2.7 million settlement. The road next to the bridge has since been renamed Kara Way, and the bridge was given the name Kara Knott Memorial Bridge. On December 2, 2000, Kara's father, Sam, suffered a fatal heart attack while tending to the garden where Kara was found murdered. His only will in life was to live long enough to attend Pyre's first parole hearing, but sadly, he never got the chance. Kathleen Rose Krausnick was born in Mount Clemens, Michigan on April 14, 1952 and went by Kathy. Kathy began dating James Krausnick, who went by Jim, while they were both students at Mount Clemens High School and married in 1974. After graduating high school, the two enrolled at West Michigan University, where Kathy graduated with a bachelor's degree in occupational therapy, and Jim graduated with a bachelor's and master's degree in economics. After graduating from West Michigan University, the two moved to Fort Collins, Colorado, where Kathy gave birth to their daughter, Sarah. In 1979, they moved to Lynchburg, Virginia, where Jim got a job as an assistant professor of economics at Lynchburg College. In 1981, they moved to Del Rio Drive in Brighton, New York, after Jim got a job as an economist at Eastman Kodak. On February 19, 1982, 30-year-old Jim returned home from work to discover Kathy had been murdered. She had suffered a single blow to the head from an axe. In a panic, Jim grabbed 3-year-old Sarah and rushed to his neighbor, Eileen Marin Keaton's home, and she called 911. Jim told police that when he arrived home, he found the garage door open and glass on the ground. He rushed upstairs and found Kathy dead in her bedroom and Sarah unharmed in her room. Investigators began to notice that the crime scene appeared to be staged as if a robbery had occurred. The only problem was nothing of value was missing. They found the contents of Kathy's purse strewn across the dining room floor with a silver tea set nearby. There was also a garbage bag next to the tea set with a shoe print on it like someone had stood on the bag to hold it open. A pair of boat boots that Jim was known to wear were found near Kathy's body and might have matched the shoe print on the garbage bag. However, investigators never tested the boots and they were not kept in evidence. As for the murder weapon, it was taken from the garage and had no fingerprints on it. Shortly before the murder, Eastman Kodak had discovered that Jim lied about having a doctorate. It's unclear if it put his job in jeopardy. Kathy was also under the impression he had received his doctorate, and when she found out otherwise, she was extremely upset. At this point, they began to have marital problems. Investigators even found marriage counseling pamphlets in Jim's car. Even with that information, Jim maintained that she was alive when he left for work that morning. Jim was their primary suspect, but they just didn't have enough evidence to convict him. This led to the case remaining unsolved for the next 40 years. In 2015, her case was reopened, and all the information was compiled into a more searchable format. After going through all the evidence, only one person remained at the top of the suspect list, Jim Krausnick. So they decided to take another crack at him, hoping to get a confession. So they showed up at his house unannounced, but unfortunately left without a confession. So they turned to DNA and sent multiple items to the FBI lab for testing. When the results came back, it didn't point to any unknown persons. At this point, they felt they had enough to charge him, but still wanted to know the exact time of Kathy's death so they could prove he was still at home. The medical examiner in 1982 could only conclude that Kathy died between 4:30 and 7:30 a.m. So in 2018, they brought in famed forensic pathologist Dr. Michael Badden, who was able to determine that Kathy died at 6:30 a.m. or earlier. In November of 2019, Jim was arrested in Arizona and charged with second-degree murder. A convicted sex offender by the name of Edward Larrabee had confessed to Kathy's murder before he died in 2014. However, investigators could find no evidence to support his claims. Still, Jim's defense team used this as their primary argument, but the jury didn't buy it and found him guilty of second-degree murder. On November 7, 2022, Jim was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. However, his stay was short because he died from cancer in May of 2023. To this day, his wife and daughter, Sarah, believe he's innocent and was wrongly convicted. However, Kathy's family is thankful for the long-awaited closure. Sharika Lavinia Adams was born to Sandra Adams on June 30, 1975, in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. At the end of 1999, 24-year-old Sharika was 8 months pregnant and living in Charlotte, North Carolina, where she worked as a real estate agent and an exotic dancer. In June of 1998, she met Ray Carruth, a wide receiver for the Carolina Panthers, at a pool party. The two began seeing each other off and on throughout the summer, but eventually fell out of touch. That is until November, when they bumped into each other again at a strip club where Sharika worked. After getting pregnant, Carruth wanted her to end the pregnancy, but she refused. She had already ended one pregnancy with an ex-boyfriend and still regretted the decision. So this time, she was determined to keep the baby, even if it meant raising the child as a single mother. As for Carruth, he had a history of getting women pregnant. When he was a sophomore at the University of Colorado, his girlfriend, Michelle Wright, gave birth to his son. Against his wishes, he was forced to pay child support and never took an interest in his child's life. His girlfriend, Amber Turner, whom he met during his senior year at college, became pregnant in 1998 after moving to North Carolina with him. He ordered her to end the pregnancy, telling her he would never have a child with someone he didn't have long-term plans with. He then threatened her by saying he could send someone to kill her if she didn't do as he wished. He also mentioned he could do the same to Michelle Wright, so he didn't have to pay child support any longer. Eventually, Amber, fearing for her life, had the pregnancy terminated. Even though Carruth was a first-round draft pick with the Carolina Panthers and had a $3.7 million contract, his time with the team was not going well. His first season was fine, but in 1998, during the season opener, he broke his foot and was out for the remainder of the season. In 1999, Carruth was back on the field and played the first 6 games of the season until everything came crashing down. On November 16, 1999, just before 1 a.m., Sharika called 911, saying she had been shot while driving. When asked what happened, she told them that Carruth was in a car in front of her, and when he slowed down, somebody pulled up next to her and began shooting. Sharika was rushed to the hospital with a total of 4 gunshot wounds. Since she was pregnant, the baby was delivered 10 weeks prematurely by an emergency C-section. 8 hours after the ordeal, Sharika woke up and could answer questions from the detectives by scribbling down notes. She said that after the shooting, Carruth took off. After falling back asleep, she would never regain consciousness, and a month later, on December 14, 1999, she sadly succumbed to her injuries. As for her son, she named him Chancellor, but doctors weren't sure if he would even survive. During that time, as Sharika lay in a coma, investigators spoke with Carruth, who denied requesting Sharika end the pregnancy. However, her friends and family said he was adamant that his finances would not be impacted by a child. The investigation eventually led them to a local drug dealer named Michael Kennedy and his best friend, Stanley Abraham, who Carruth had met at a car accessory shop. After questioning Kennedy, it led investigators to Van Brett Watkins, who worked as a security guard at a strip club. There were rumors that Watkins was a hitman, and he even claimed to have killed 4 people. Before Sharika died, Kennedy, Abraham, Watkins, and Carruth were all four arrested and charged with her murder. Carruth was able to post a $3 million bail with a stipulation that he would not leave the country and that if Sharika died, he would turn himself in. However, after Sharika's death, Carruth did the opposite and convinced Wendy Cole, who was heading to California for cosmetology school, to let him tag along. When they stopped at a Best Western in Wildersville, Tennessee, Carruth informed his mother where he was. Fearing for his safety, she informed the police and the bail bondsmen of his location, and he was subsequently taken into custody. During the trial, Carruth claimed that he and drug dealer Watkins had fallen out over a drug deal that Carruth was supposed to finance. However, Watkins would end up telling a completely different story. He said that Carruth had hired him for the hit on Sharika and had threatened to kill Kennedy if he refused to assist. Watkins said he met Carruth in 1999 through a mutual friend and began doing odd jobs for him. He said about 3 weeks after they met, Carruth asked him how much he would charge to beat up Sharika to the point that she would lose the baby. Watkins said he responded, "I don't beat up a girl, I kill people." They ultimately agreed on $6,000, three before and three after the murder. He said that Carruth actively participated in the planning of the murder, which involved Carruth asking Sharika to the movies. Once the plan was in motion, Carruth and Sharika met at the theater and watched a movie. After the movie, Carruth told her he wanted to spend the night at her home, so they headed that way with Carruth in the lead. At some point, Carruth stopped in front of her on Raya Road, allowing Kennedy to pull up next to her and block her in. That's when Watkins shot her with a .38 caliber gun. After the murder, Watkins said he contemplated killing Kennedy and Abraham so there would be no witnesses besides Carruth. On January 19, 2001, Carruth was found guilty and sentenced to 18 to 24 years behind bars. As for Kennedy, Abraham, and Watkins, they all three took plea deals. Abraham served less than 2 years before being released. Kennedy was released in 2011 after serving 11 years, and Watkins took a second-degree murder plea and is eligible for parole in 2046. In October 2018, 44-year-old Carruth was released from prison and moved to Pennsylvania. He has since apologized to Sharika's mother, Sandra, and sent her a check to help with his son, Chancellor, who thankfully did survive but suffered permanent brain damage and cerebral palsy. Chancellor has overcome a lot of obstacles and can now walk and talk and has made straight A's in school. The Carolina Panthers even paid for him and Sandra to attend their London game in 2019. Chancellor is now 24 years old and a long way from the moment doctors weren't sure if he could even survive. On May 27, 2014, human remains were discovered by a hiker near Idle Road on state game lands in Rye Township, Pennsylvania. It was determined that the unknown individual was a white male between the ages of 45 and 70. It was estimated that the remains had been in that location anywhere from 7 to 20 months. The John Doe had died from multiple gunshot wounds, and his death was ruled a homicide. For nearly 9 years, his identity would unfortunately remain unknown. In October of 2022, Othram and their genetic genealogy team got to work tracing back the John Doe's family tree, using DNA recovered from several items found with the remains. Finally, in February of 2023, the John Doe's identity was revealed as 47-year-old Michael Allen Holliber, who disappeared 2 hours away in Strasburg, Virginia in 2012. Now that investigators had a name, they began to piece together the events that led to his murder. Investigators quickly determined that 48-year-old James Edgar Callahan murdered Michael in a home in Strasburg. He then likely picked a place he was familiar with and dumped the body. On September 26, 2023, Callahan was arrested during a traffic stop and charged with first-degree murder for the death of Michael. Unfortunately, most of the details in the case remained sealed by the court. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.